Thank you for downloading the Plod podcast, Police Law on Demand, brought to you by 3D solicitors and barristers from Sergeants in Chambers. In our podcast series, we are going to discuss a range of topics affecting police officers and anyone involved in the criminal justice system. For more updates on police law, follow the Sergeants in Police Law blog at ukpolicelawblog.com. If you have any suggestions for any topics that you would like us to cover, please email plod@3d-solicitors.com. My name is Deborah Brittstone of 3D Solicitors, and I'm joined today by John Beggs, barrister at Sergeants in Chambers, for the second episode discussing commanding police armed operations. And in this episode, we'll cover briefings and then on to post-incident procedures. Thank you for joining us again, John. We left off talking about the risk in terms of overhyped or inaccurate intelligence packages. So can we just talk about the briefing process then?
If time permits, which it's likely to on a pre-planned operation as opposed to a spontaneous one, the briefing of the SFOs should ideally be scripted. It should be written out so that it can be carefully checked. And all such briefings must be very clear as to the operational intentions and objectives. And of course, terminology should be commonly understood. It's been a feature of some public inquiries that there have been misunderstandings as to what particular words mean in the context of a particular operation. So, to take an example, detail as to the intervention or extraction will be required, and the briefing has to be specific. Will the vehicle be stationary? Will the target vehicles have tinted windows or not? Who precisely will be in the vehicle? How many people will be in the vehicle? What are the intentions and capabilities of those within the vehicle? How do we know that? What intelligence was it based on? What is the grading or antiquity of that intelligence? Judges much prefer it if briefings are recorded on body-worn video. In truth, there is very little excuse not to record on body-worn video, and this has been a theme of judicial comment for over a decade now, and thus it becomes ever more difficult to justify not doing that. To the extent that those in command are concerned about sensitive police tactics, His Honour Judge Goldstone made very clear in the Jermaine Baker report, any such sensitivities can be dealt with by way of redacting parts of the video. So that's not a good excuse for not using body worn. Finally, this, if you don't record the briefing in an auditable fashion, such as body worn, all that those in command are doing is creating an opportunity for those who are seeking to criticize the police operation to create uncertainty and even a sense of conspiracy. The absence of the recorded briefing will itself raise conspiratorial type questions.
So pre-strike, what would be the key questions?
Prior to the strike or the intervention by the armed officers, the key questions for those in command are going to be, why this tactic? Why now? That's always a very important question, because that's the specificity of the operation in question. Why are we going in now? What precisely is my intelligence picture? What is the compelling reason for intervention? Does my intelligence picture have holes in it? Am I in command reducing to the maximum extent possible the risk of recourse by the SFOs to lethal force? Are there any less intrusive but nonetheless effective tactics available to me? If there are, why am I excluding them? If this is sustained public protection, precisely how will I protect the public by this intervention as opposed to something that might be less dangerous? And those in command might consider it a useful discipline to list out the points in favour of their intervention now and the points against, simply to see on a piece of paper visually whether there is in fact a compelling picture justifying intervention, or whether, as is not entirely uncommon, sometimes a certain momentum has gathered pace and is very difficult to stall.
And what do those in command of armed operations have to prove?
Well, the sort of points that they are going to have to deal with at any inquest or public inquiry, or, of course, I should have added, potentially a civil claim, will be questions such as, when was I first called in to this job? What was I first told? Who told me that? Did they tell me in writing or did they tell me on the telephone? Where was I when I was told that? What did I advise or direct as a result of what I was told, and when and why? And so, of course, those in command would do well to retain copies of any materials with which they are briefed. That might be an email, it might be a text message, it might be an intelligence package. The reason it's worth keeping all such material is that when the IOPC come in to investigate, very often there's a degree of chaos as material becomes dissipated, sometimes lost. So it's in the officer's own interest to retain that which they were provided with. So those questions, what was I told, by whom, when, what did I advise, and why and when, those questions repeat themselves over the course of the operation. And of course, some operations may last many days. And so the position changes, the evidence changes, the intelligence changes. And so the quality of the officer's records needs to be high so as to reflect those changes in evidence or intelligence. Furthermore, the longer the operation goes on, as a general rule, the greater the expectation of the reviewing court that those in command will have steadfastly looked to improve the intelligence picture and thereby refine their operational tactics. Innately dangerous operations, hard stops, extractions from vehicles, require the most intense justification, since history shows they tend to have the most serious outcomes, namely fatalities. And cases like Azel Rodney, Mark Duggan, Jermaine Baker are three very high-profile examples.
So when there is a fatality, when someone is shot dead, what are the post-incident imperatives?
The short answer is to demonstrate first that the scene of the shooting itself has been forensically preserved without anything being done to it which can cause doubts as to the integrity of the scene. Another imperative is to ensure that the Independent Office for Police Conduct, the IOPC, is informed of the shooting by the police as soon as practicable. And by ASAP, we mean ideally within the hour. Another imperative is to ensure that the investigation is truly independent of the police force in question. Of course, that relates to the second point about getting the IOPC in as quickly as possible. Now, sometimes if the shooting happens late at night or very early in the morning, it's possible that the IOPC, even doing their best, will not be on the scene as quickly as might be desirable. And so, of course, it follows that the local force may have to bring in its own officers and staff to ensure forensic integrity of the scene and the key exhibits. That is unobjectionable in principle, provided it is done in a transparent fashion, ideally with body-worn video tracking what's going on. It is no exaggeration to say that it is the mistakes made after the shooting, which are often the cause of as many problems, if not more, for the police than the conduct of the operation itself. And this is because it's all too easy for well-intentioned activities after a shooting to be misconstrued as pursuant to some conspiracy to cover up. This is particularly true with things like key exhibits being inexplicably moved, or occasionally, worse than that, disappearing. And famously on the Duggan case, the vehicle in which Mark Duggan was traveling was moved, understandably creating consternation in the local community, particularly when the vehicle was then replaced in situ. Other key exhibits in that case, such as the shoebox in which the weapon was said to have been carried, weren't perhaps handled with the efficacy that might have been desirable. It's important, therefore, that those responsible for the immediate aftermath of fatal shootings do their very best to maintain the forensic integrity of all relevant scenes. It's perhaps best not to use the word crime scene, since that implies that there's been a crime, but every forensic scene that may be relevant, and I stress may be relevant, to the shooting needs to be effectively cordoned off and preserved until the IOPC arrive and do whatever forensication processes they see fit. So particular errors of mistake that have been noted historically are failure to lock down the scene of the shooting or other scenes, particularly vehicles in which people are traveling, failure to handle key exhibits with skill and care, so that it cannot be said against the police that anyone has interfered with or compromised their integrity, and that a particular area of controversy is the question of conferring between key police witnesses, which should not occur beyond that which is necessary for safety or operational reasons. Thereafter, officers should not discuss the incident, not because anyone's implying that they're guilty of anything, but because conferring after the event is liable to lead to the situation where officers start to assimilate other people's evidence into their own. This can be entirely innocent, but nonetheless, innocent contamination of someone's recollection can be every bit as serious as less innocent contamination. And so if the post-incident phase is not handled skillfully, according to the APP, there is a serious prospect for those who might wish to criticize the police to identify and promote theories of cover-up and so forth. The post-incident manager, of course, has a overarching role in ensuring the integrity of the post-incident phase of any operation. But as the APP makes very clear, the SFC, the TFC, and the OFC alike also all have important post-incident functions, an overarching example of which is the duty on all of them to ensure a good audit trail of their post-incident actions.
Do you have any overarching observations for us to consider?
Yes, one overarching observation is that those in command of armed policing operations need to be very conversant with the College of Policing's APP on armed policing, and of course their own specific duties, which are going to be different as between SFC, TFC and OFC. It's also not a particularly good idea for individual forces to develop their own standard operating procedures, which depart from the APP, because once you have a departure from the APP, that will be a line of attack against the police asking you to justify that departure. But in reality, commanders are only going to be able to comply with the APP if they are regularly rereading it and reviewing it. And it's not uncommon, unfortunately, for local forces to start by custom and practice to develop language which isn't adherent to the APP. And although this may be entirely innocent and possibly inconsequential, it can contribute
to the impression that the local force isn't bothering to follow the APP. It has to be remembered that inquest and public inquiry proceedings are very adversarial. Very often, one group of lawyers are looking to do as much damage forensically as they can to the police case. And police officers are sometimes surprised how a good barrister can cross-examine them for hours on just one departure from the APP. And if they can make you concede that the APP is in effect the Bible of operational doctrine, the more departures they can demonstrate to the jury or to the judge, the more they will be able to make you look unprofessional. So if you have to depart from the APP, or if you did perhaps for a good reason which you didn't note down, your duty is going to be to justify your departure. Another key observation is that record keeping, it can be very mixed in its quality. There is no magical way of keeping records. There's nothing wrong with pro formas, provided the police officers filling them in don't become casual. There's nothing wrong with a piece of blank paper if that's all you had at your disposal. If you were sitting in Nando's when the first call came in and you had to make notes on the back of the menu, then you should keep that menu as an exhibit of what you were told, because it's got your contemporaneous record. There's nothing, for example, wrong with voice notes as long as you keep them all. There's nothing wrong with making notes on a laptop as long as you keep them all, and as long as you keep in mind the risks of version control. The most important thing about records is that they are contemporaneously timed and that they record as accurately as humanly possible what you were told, who told you, when they told you, and what you then decided to do, and what, if any, directions or orders you gave. So those questions, the repeated five or six key questions, have to find expression in your contemporaneous records. If, however, the pace of the operation or your location prevents you from keeping adequate contemporaneous records, then the sensible thing to do is that as soon as you are able to make a note, to do so and to reflect very carefully that the note you're making is retrospective. The best way to do that, of course, is to time the precise signature at the end of your note so that nobody can claim that you're trying to give the appearance of a contemporaneous note when in fact it was made up retrospectively.
Do you have any final reflections for us to think about?
Yes. If a police armed operation results in a fatal or non-fatal shooting, it is as well to make up your main statement, perhaps 36 to 48 hours after the event, on your own and in some detail while matters are tolerably clear in your mind. Now, if you were a commander, SFC or TFC, you might not need to wait for 48 hours. And indeed, some judges have observed that we wouldn't ask ordinary witnesses to delay before making a statement. So if you're fit and healthy, not exhausted, actually, you might think it better to make your main detailed statement of what happened as soon as practicable. The other thing to bear in mind is if there has been a fatality, you might want to speak to your force solicitor in conference sooner rather than later. And the reason for this is to ensure that the force in question is doing all it can to make sure that all relevant evidence is carefully collated for use at any later legal proceedings. Of course, that particular endeavour may have to be refined if the IOPC is investigating, because, of course, they will have primacy in the investigative domain. But in relation to the potential litigation which will follow any fatal shooting, it's certainly a truism that the sooner the relevant police witnesses see their lawyer, their force lawyer, generally speaking, the better. And just to conclude, the reality is that a fatal shooting can have career retarding or even career ending effects on some officers. And that's why I've been stressing throughout that those in command and control need to be exquisitely familiar with the APP. And those who are going to be commanding difficult armed operations would perhaps do well to read the key case law, such as McCann, and some of the key public inquiry reports, such as Rodney, Granger, and Baker. After all, why would you not want to understand how judges analyze armed operations and how they tend to focus their criticisms?
Thank you, John. It's been very helpful and interesting and lots to think about. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Plod podcast, Police Law on Demand, brought to you by 3D solicitors and barristers from Sergeants in Chambers. For more updates on police law, follow the Sergeants in Police Law blog at ukpolicelawblog.com. If you have any suggestions for any topics that you would like us to cover, please email plod@3d-solicitors.com.